session number 18774, Reel 2.
Tony Southast, Reel 2. Can you describe what you saw of the damage to the American warship?
Oh yes, there was one heavy cruiser with her bows blown completely away, and she looked as if she'd been chopped off from just forward of the bridge. Both gun turrets had gone, both A and B gun turrets had gone, and she was just lying there, a hulk. There was another cruiser, the USS Boise, B-O-I-S-E, and she'd been bombed, and she'd been hit heavily on the starboard side, and there was a big hole there. Also, one of our own New Zealand cruisers, HMS NZS Leander, had been hit on X turret, which was manned by Marines, and she'd had heavy casualties. But she was, as a ship, she was perfectly all right, apart from needing a new gun turret.
Whereabouts did you see these damage?
This was in New Caledonia. we then were sent off to a place called Bora Bora to refuel and also to search for some raider called the Black Prince or something, which we never found, and then returned to New Zealand. Well, while I was serving in Manawai, I was recommended for a commission. And so I couldn't get home, but by then I'd done just over 2 years as a seaman. And fortunately, the ship was ordered home to England.
What date is this now about? Roughly, just from memory.
I would say somewhere around June, July of 42. Maybe August 42. And we left there and came home via Panama. And I always remember we all stocked up with sugar and all the foodstuffs we could buy in New Zealand, because we knew there was a shortage of food at home and we wanted to take this to our parents. This was the 30 Englishmen, but all the New Zealanders as well bought lots of sugar and candy and cigarettes and stuff for the people at home. And when we got home, and I was terribly lucky because the ship came into Liverpool, and we picked up the Liverpool pilot at the bar light vessel and came into Liverpool, where the Manawai was converted to a headquarters ship, landing headquarters ship. I didn't know that at the time.
Had the Manawai been damaged at all?
Not at all. Not at all, no. We were bombed once, but no hits and no really near misses, so that really we had no casualties at all.
Bombed by Japanese aircraft?
That's right.
Why did they miss you?
Because they weren't good enough to hit us. They just dived down on us in New Hebrides Harbour and dropped bombs and missed us. Saratoga, the American aircraft carrier, was also in harbour, and presumably they were aiming at her, because we were lying just about two cables away from her. And they missed us. Well, then when I got back to Liverpool, we were all absolutely disgusted to find that the HM Customs came on board and confiscated all our presents for our family, except for about half a pound of sugar or something, and all the rest was taken and distributed, presumably to the people, including all the New Zealanders' presents. It was all distributed to the local population. So I learned afterwards. Well, then I came home and I had a fortnight's leave. I'd been away from home for something like a year and a half. And I came home and had a fortnight's leave and was sent off for a commission to HMS King Alfred in Brighton.
What was that like?
Well, I found it very hard going, because I'd never been particularly clever at mathematics. And in fact, at school, I was never particularly brilliant. I concentrated on getting a rugby cap and a cricket cap and a few things like that, but mathematics was not my good subject. So that when I went to HMS King Alfred and we did torpedoes, gunnery, navigation, signals, etc., when it came to doing the navigation, which had mathematics in it, I found it very hard going, and I had to work very hard, And in fact, I was determined to get this commission. And whilst all the other chaps were going ashore on a run ashore to Brighton, I stayed behind and had to swap my maths to try and catch up with the rest. Because you have to bear in mind that from the age of 16 and a half, 17 onwards, I hadn't done any mathematics or any schoolwork or that type of work at all. I'd been an ordinary and able seaman doing seamanship. But where I did score very heavily was that I was way ahead of the others at seamanship, because the others had only done about 6 weeks or 3 months at sea before they came ashore for a commission, and they didn't know the very simplest things when the divisional officer asked us questions on boat work and so on. It all came second nature to me, but to them they didn't know what it was all about. So I gained on that side, and I eventually qualified, I think, after... I think it was a 6 weeks course. I qualified as a sub-lieutenant, and I never forget being so relieved that I'd managed to pass through. But my divisional officer, who was a fellow I've always looked up to very much, was a chap called Lieutenant Commander Hetherington, RN, who was an ex-destroyer officer who'd been sent ashore for a break because he'd had a very heavy war in the Mediterranean and he'd lost a couple of ships. And he was a wonderful man, and he told me afterwards, he said, I remember him saying, well, Southers, he said, I recommended you for a commission, he said, but never as a navigator. So I went home on leave after the usual passing out party with Hetherington, who I may say was a wonderful man in as much as he used to sit cross-legged on the floor and play a clarinet. And when he wasn't doing that, he used to sit in his room, and he used to be a great man at knitting, and he knitted socks and scarves and goodness knows what. He went back to sea, and he became a Rear Admiral. And he died about a year ago, 2 years ago. But he was a wonderful man and a great example. So then I went home, and I had, I think, a fortnight's leave, and I was sent to HMS Cam, a frigate.
How do you spell Cam?
C-A-M, River Class Frigate. And she was building or completing building in Greenock. So I went up to Greenock and I got there, and the first thing I was told was to go and see the captain, who was in an office ashore in Scott's Shipyard, it was. Scott's of Greenock.
About what date have we reached?
This
now?
Was, we're now reached 1943 September. And I went and reported to the captain, and he's a very nice Lieutenant Commander RNR called J.P. Smythe. And he'd been with Union Castle Line, but he'd got a DSC, and he was a very pleasant gentleman. And so was the first lieutenant called Lee, and about five other officers. And we stood by the ship for something like 3 weeks and then went out on trials. And by that time, the captain had said to me, well, by the way, Southers, you're going to be the navigator. So I felt like saying, well, I've just been told I'll never be a navigator. So anyway, I took over the job of navigator, and then an RNR sub-lieutenant joined us from the South African Navy. And he became the navigator because he'd been a navigator, obviously, in merchant vessels prior to the war. So I was then told I was going to be what is known as the quarter-deck officer. I was responsible for the quarter-deck and the depth charges and everything to do with that side of life. We did our trials, and we ran trials and so on and so forth, and then we went back out into the Atlantic to join an escort group, the 6th Escort Group, which was 5 Canadian frigates and 1 British, the 1 British one being us. We did first convoy we did. The first convoy we picked up consisted of something like 50 to 60 vessels and was an eastbound convoy, and we had no trouble at all. We picked this convoy up, formed out on the wings in good weather, and we were somewhere off Northern Ireland on the way to come down the Minches when we received a signal to go to the aid of an American destroyer which had been torpedoed. By this time, the wind and the sea were coming up, and it was straight into the nose, and we went straight back out to this destroyer, which had been what we would call netted. An acoustic torpedo had hit the stern end of the ship and bent the whole stern end up, and she was lying helpless. We didn't know where the U-boat was, but the whole group then carried a search round and round this destroyer, which we tried to take in tow. Eventually succeeded in taking it in tow and took it in towards Southern Ireland. And as we approached Southern Ireland, a tug came out and took over from us. And we were then proceeded into Londonderry, joined the rest of the group, had 4 days' rest before we went back out for the next convoy. The average time in harbour was somewhere around 4 to 7 days. It depended on whether you came in for boiler cleaning. If you had boiler cleaning, you generally had 7 days, and you could send one watch on leave. Anyway, from convoy work in the North Atlantic, we were then sent down to the Mediterranean with a fast 16-knot convoy consisting of 3 ships into the Mediterranean. We had a bit of trouble with U-boats there, dropped a lot of depth charges, but had no firm indication that we had sunk anything. We'd carried out several attacks, even one into Gibraltar Straits, where we contacted a U-boat and where we left the three convoy vessels, which were going on to Oran. We left them there and searched for this U-boat for a long time in conjunction with an American aircraft, and another British destroyer joined us. We had a lot of contacts, and we dropped what were known as 26 charge patterns, but only oil and nothing definite came to the surface to convince us that we had sunk a U-boat. To get an actual U-boat sinking, at the time, originally it was thought that all you had to do was get a depth charge within 10 or 20 yards of a U-boat. But in actual fact, it turned out later on that we had to be within something like 10 feet with a minor charge to get any effective damage, and this is very difficult. After this...
You said that you were the quarterdeck officer, and that involved looking after depth charge.
Yes.
How do you look after depth charges?
Well, when I say look after depth charges, you have to... Before you carry out a depth charge attack, you'd either carry out a 5-charge pattern, a 10-charge pattern, or a 26-charge creeping pattern, it was called. Now, all the depth charges have to be primed, and they have to have a pistol set to the depth required. And the depth required varied from 50 feet right down to 700. 700 laterally, and on those 700, we had heavy weights placed on the depth charges. Each depth charge was fired from the bridge from what was known as Asdicks. Asdicks used to pick up a U-boat echo, and then they would decide on the bridge what depths they wanted to set. They would tell us the depths to set on the depth charges, which we did by a depth charge pistol. There was a little thing set on 75, 150, and so on. And we then fired these in HMS Cam, which was a new ship. We fired them by lights coming on the depth charge racks and on the depth charge throws. So when the man attending the depth charge rail, light came on, he'd pull the depth charge stick, pull the depth charge lever back, and the depth charge would roll over the stern, or he would fire the thrower. And that was our undoing, because eventually we got home from the Mediterranean, back into Londonderry, and it was at Londonderry by this time we're coming towards D-Day. And 2 days prior to D-Day, we told to assemble in Moultrie Bay. When we got to Moultrie Bay, there were something like 100 escort vessels lying waiting to go, and it was there that we first received our orders to go to, I think, Operation Overlord. And our job, again, with the 5 other frigates, the Canadian group, was to escort 2 carriers, aircraft carriers, small aircraft carriers, called escort carriers, Pursuer and Tracker. And we were to escort them into the channel, and they were going to fly off and bomb the beaches and the area just inland from the beaches. And we were to go in and sweep up the U-boats, if there were any in that area, together with all the other 100 escort vessels. Well, this turned out to be when eventually we sailed on the day. And I suppose the 2 days at anchor in Moultrie Bay Well, the only time, or well, one of the few times when I was really frightened, because we didn't really know what we were going to, what to expect. We thought we were going to be heavily bombed. We thought we were going to meet a lot of U-boats. We thought we were going to be into surface action with enemy destroyers doing everything they could to defend the coast. Well, the truth of the matter was that we sailed, and off Land's End on a flat, calm night with a full moon, one of the Canadian frigates thought he got a contact and put himself right across the bows of one of the aircraft escort carriers and was very nearly cut in half. So our first task was to pick up the bits and pieces from there, and we took them into Falmouth, the survivors, and then we came out again and joined the group and went into the beaches. Well, we had a fairly quiet run into the beaches, and as one stage we again got contact with U-boats, but again we got nothing definite. We thought that we'd got one, but as a group, not just as the individual ship. And four of us were all dropping depth charges, and one was guiding the other in and carrying out attacks. And it was known that U-boats would lie stopped on the bottom and wait for you to pass over them and then come up and have a go at you. Also, they were firing magnetic torpedoes. Anyway, this went on, and we went told to, the Battle of Caen, C-A-E-N, started, and we were told to go into the beaches and shell the just inland of Caen from RT, from the senior officer. We did that and fired off, I don't know how many rounds, probably about 80 rounds of 4-inch from the 2 4-inch guns we had. And we then came out and continued on a patrol about 30 miles south of Portsmouth, when we again got a very good U-boat contact. This appeared on the Asdix that the U-boat was moving. It appeared to be some 20 feet off the bottom. We ran an echo sounder trace over it. We had very good Asdic contact with us. One of the other group, the HMCS Canadian frigate Cape Breton, came in. He got a very good contact too. He thought it was a U-boat. And then the senior officer, who was a commander in the Canadian Navy, in a ship called HMCS Waskasui, he told us to go in and drop a 10-charge pattern on it. Well, we moved out and then got the contact again and came running in at it, doing something like 16 to 18 knots. Well, I was the depth charge officer, standing right aft, supervising the ratings, dropping the depth charges, and we dropped two at about the first one at 50 feet and the next one at 150, and then we fired the port thrower. Well, after we'd fired the port thrower, there was a huge explosion. And according to the eyewitnesses in Cape Breton, who were standing off about 200 to 300 yards away from us, the explosion was somewhere like 250 feet high, three times the height of our mast. The ship lurched and heaved heavily over to starboard, lying almost on her side. And I thought that she was going to go straight over. I also thought at the time that we had hit a mine-carrying submarine, and that it was this that had caused such a huge explosion. It was only afterwards, when we walked round, when I walked round the decks, and we had somewhere like 43 injured and very heavily wounded men lying on the steel decks, and also we had shrapnel, sea bottom, sand, seaweed lying all over our decks, and then a tidal wave hit us, heeled the ship over and flattened everyone that was on the decks. Well, after that, I was quite dumbfounded for a minute. I couldn't understand what was happening, and the ship had stopped and was lying on her with a heavy list to starboard. Well, I was a quarter-deck officer, and I opened the tiller flat, which is right down aft. There's a tiller flat hatch, and the after steering gear is down there, and a vertical ladder going down. And I opened the hatch and started to go down, and I could hear the water pouring in under high pressure through the where all the rivet holes had gone and where there was a crack in the plating. And I started to go down there, and I fell about 10 feet, down into the bilges, which were full of oil. And the reason I'd fallen was that the vertical iron ladder was buckled in the middle, and so when I put my feet down, there was nothing there, and my hands just slipped and I fell down. Anyway, eventually I got back up on deck, and I got some pumps. I asked to get the electric pumps going, but there was no power. There was, the engine room was on fire, the boiler room was, both petty officers were lying flat with their skulls cracked. One, his leg was in a terrible mess. And so I started going around. I went up to the bridge to report. The captain had his back broken. The first lieutenant was sitting on a locker with his legs hanging over the locker, and he'd fractured his legs. The navigator was lying on one side with his arm in a, holding his arm, and then another officer, the officer of the watch, he was sitting there, and he also had broken his ankles. The shock of the explosion underneath the ship had caused all this damage. There were ratings on, with the calves of their legs hanging off, where they'd split across the calf of the leg. I was nearest to the explosion, and I seemed to be the only one who didn't seem to be injured. So I set about trying to do something for the injured and trying to do what I could for the ship. I went down the engine room, and the engines and action turbines had actually left their bedding, jumped up and settled down again. I went down the stokehold with a Robinson stretcher, and I managed to get the stokers onto the stretchers and men up top to pull them up. It's about a 30-foot pull-up, a vertical ladder, and a round hatch at the top. And we managed to get these two chaps up and then tended to as best we could. And I suppose I went round tending the injured for the next 2 or 3 hours. And then we got the ship into tow, and we towed her in, and she was completely wrecked. The decks were like walking along a rough sea. They were up and down. I went to where my cabin was, and I had a canary in there. And the canary was lying in its cage underneath a little library of books I had on the bulkhead. That had come down, and the canary was underneath it all. My desk had come away from the bulkhead or the wall, and all my gear on my desk, my fountain pen and things, had all fallen down through the gap down into the bilges somewhere, and it was a complete chaos. And there was oil leaking all over, and the ship was in a bad way. I then went off to help to put the fire out in the engine with the engineer warrant officer, who was very shaken and was an old man. He was about 40, which was old to me. I was 21. And I helped him get the fire out, and then I went up and reported to the bridge, and the captain said, do what you can for the crew and the ship, because nobody else can. They're all hurt or injured. So I then went back down aft, and I got all the bandages and stuff I could, and I tried to bandage the people up and prop them up and lean them on something. And I left them there, and literally it was a bad state. Even the ship's boats were wrecked. The naval whaler had its back broken, and that was lying, one end of it was hanging from the davits. And it was a dreadful mess. Anyway, eventually a tug came out, and he put huge 8-inch hoses down the tiller and started pumping us out and pulling us back. The long and the short of it was that the ship was totally wrecked, and that was the end of her. From there I was sent on survivor's leave. I had 2 weeks survivor's leave at home, and I was then sent to HMS Clover, a Flower-class corvette.
Before we talk about that, can you tell me what had actually happened, as you must have discovered later?
I discovered later on, because of all the seashells and the shrapnel and the bits of pieces of ammunition lying around the deck, we had hit a sunken ammunition ship. Years later, many years later, I got a report of proceedings from Kew Gardens, which is a letter from the captain to the Captain D in Portsmouth, from Captain D to the Admiralty, and from the Admiralty, and the report gives the full details of the whole episode and also recommends various officers and ratings for their behavior. And it's a very fine report, and that confirmed that we had in fact hit a sunken ammunition ship. Now they say, the Admiralty in this report, that there were two ammunition ships in our area, and that in fact they should have been on our charts. But there was no indication on our charts that there were any, and I'm quite sure with six vessels in the group, one of them would have picked up the fact that they were ammunition ships. But they weren't, and that's one of those things in war that you have to expect.
So this was the end of HMS Cam?
That was the end of HMS Cam.
In June 1944?
That's right.
Don't worry about the date, because that's in the record
okay.
Anyway. Had this been a happy ship for
she
you?
She was blown up on the 18th of July. Yes, she had been she was a happy ship, but we had a brand new crew who knew nothing in terms of, you know, there were seamen there who'd only been in the Navy a couple of months, and a lot of them, and we had a crew of about, I think it was 143, of whom 43 were injured, seriously. And in fact, 9 of them went ashore and 2 died. So it was a very bad explosion and a very bad experience for the new boys. As I say, I think that is war, and that's what you have to expect. And I don't say that with any bravery whatsoever, because up until then I'd had a fairly easy war. I'd never had to swim. I'd never had injured fellows lying around the place. But when it happened in a big way. And it did have an effect on me, in as much as when I came home on leave, if a door banged, I was in a pretty unfortunate state. I jumped around in a bit of a panic. And when I went to the corvette after a fortnight's leave, the first thing we did was went out on depth charge trials. And the first depth charge, when the captain said fire, my legs went under me and I was standing on the bridge. And I fell on the bridge. My legs just disintegrated to jelly. People talk about your legs give way when you're frightened. Well, I was so frightened that my legs gave way. And they all thought I'd just fallen down. But funnily enough, after that, I was perfectly okay. I got used to the whole thing again, and we went back on North Atlantic convoys.
So this is HMS Clover?
This was HMS Clover, the Flyer Class Corvette. And we were a member of B2 Group, and we were running from Londonderry to Newfoundland with convoys each way, about 5 days in harbour each time at each end. It used to take us up to 22 days to get across, depending on the weather. But it was the weather in the North Atlantic that I remember more than anything else, I think. At the end of the time, HMS Clover, we ended up in 1945 going up to Campbelltown to teach people on anti-submarine warfare in the Clover. I never had a shore job from January 41 onwards. And we came and we were teaching chaps on anti-submarine warfare preparatory to going to the Far East. Well, fortunately, the Far East war finished before we went out there. And so I then was left with the ship, and we took her up to Greenock, funnily enough, where we started from. I think it was Clarence Dock in Greenock. And we started paying her off, and fellows were being demobbed and sent away, and I became first lieutenant. And I stayed with the ship for about 4 months, 5 months before my time came. I tried to join the RN, but it was only a 7-year commission. And that wasn't good enough or long enough for me, so I left and came back to the job I'd been in originally, in the shipping company. And that's another story.
How did living conditions...